Your SteveJonesShow.com audio is coming up next. Audio and podcast of The Steve Jones Show, a service of Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is The Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Hola, buenos dias. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. We're going to have Tom Hart from the Big Ten Network on, also from the Atlanta Braves Television Network. He'll join us at 3:35. Kevin can then go on siesta for a while, make a sandwich, have himself a refreshing beverage.
That sounds like a plan right there.
And then in the second hour, Ron Cook, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Tomorrow, Bill Carollo, supervisor of officials in the Big Ten for football, and Rick Boyajas, supervisor of officials in the Big Ten for men's basketball. And coming up on Friday, we'll have Dick Girardi from the Belmont Stakes. On Monday, Penn State football coach Bill O'Brien. We are now joined by the Prince of Bitterness, Kevin Herr.
I'm not bitter today. I don't think I am anyway. I wasn't when the day started.
You were bitter when the day started?
No, I said I wasn't bitter when the day started.
You were?
No. Did you see one of the more interesting things to come out of the sports world lately regarding things that we've talked about on this program? Former Florida State coach Bobby Bowden wants ex-coaches to be on the committee to select teams now for the championship for football. Ed says he would be one that would do it.
Wonderful.
I knew you'd be excited.
It's just what we need.
He'd be daggum proud to do it.
Well, that's because he got 8 dadgum charges on his.
Yeah, come on. Now you took all of my.
I sound like a man who'd have 5 dadgum charges.
Now you took all the fun out of that.
Peggy, dadgum?
That was good, though.
I'm not too old to find you, son.
Oh. I just thought it was interesting. You know, we've talked about that, having that selection committee just this week.
Right, we have, as a matter of fact. Interesting. By the way, Jordan Cirenka, who's been on the show before.
Yes.
Was drafted by the Pirates. Guess where they're going to send him?
Right home.
Yep.
Right to State College.
He's coming to State College.
Well.
21st round pick. No, I think for the franchise, it's great. The kid can play.
Well, it should save on moving expenses.
The kid can flat out play. Let's see.
All I know is when he comes up.
Before we get that, wonderful email from Bonnie Wasmer about the Purdy Memorial Golf Tournament.
Yes.
How nice of her. That was very, very nice. We're greatly appreciative of that. And next year, Drew and Mark and I will be more than happy to be at the tournament again.
Hmm? I said, who are you going to get to replace me then?
Oh, we can run a contest. Our number is 1-800-795-9565. That is 1-800-795-9565. And
when you start chuckling like that, I know I'm in deep trouble.
Oh, no. It's just,
Yes.
Just going through my email, scrolling through the email, just checking, a lot of negative stuff about you, but that's all right.
No, that's all right. You should be used to reading that right now.
No, that's just for management.
Oh,
you really should be used to it.
Should be very happy, by the way. Tom Coughlin signed a 2-year extension with the Giants for 2014.
Well, I mean, I think that's great. Look, the guy's won 2 Super Bowls.
I was going to say, was he really not going? Were they really not going to offer him an extension?
No. Well, of course, the big story is the NBA. Now, here's, and then, of course, tonight, a Stanley Cup can be won tonight. And even in the offseason, I want to point out, I am trying to get on before the month is out, Doc Emmerich, on the show.
That would be great. The problem, like I said, the Kings may end the season here early.
Well, no, I'd rather do it offseason.
Sure.
Because Penn State's going into hockey for the first time since 1947 at a varsity level. And also, before the summer is out, I'm working on this one. Paul Henderson. This is the part now where I have to explain to my co-host who he is.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. I shall explain.
All right.
Penn State's going into hockey.
I'm familiar with that.
Varsity level, first time 1947.
Right.
40 years ago, 1972, Canada put its professionals on the ice to play against the Soviet Union in an 8-game series.
Okay.
Now, everyone thought that the Canadians would wipe the Soviet Union off the ice with their professionals. Now, the Canadians were a little shorthanded at the time. Bobby Orr, they were just coming off a Stanley Cup. Orr just won the second Stanley Cup. This is his legend. You have to have two. It's not enough, you know. Even though, like, winning one is really, really hard.
It's not enough.
Yeah, for the Kevin Hur culturist.
Agreed.
For me, it is more than enough.
Your standards are lower than mine.
No, I know it's difficult. That's the difference. And he had just won his second Stanley Cup with the Bruins, but he had bad knees and he needed surgery after the cup was over. He won the Conn Smythe Trophy as the Stanley Cup MVP and just was at the peak of his career. And Bobby Hull, they couldn't have Bobby Hull, who was at the peak of his career, because he had just signed with the WHA. The newly formed WHA. He had just signed with them, so it was only NHL players. So no Orr, no Hull, but believe me, the Canadians are not panicking 40 years ago. They are not panicking at all. Why? Because they're the NHL. So they get together, I don't know, a couple weeks before the start of this series in September 72, and they play the series. And they start the series out. They play first, the four games are in Canada. And they play at the Forum of Montreal. They play at Maple Leaf Gardens. Then they play in Winnipeg at the old Winnipeg Arena. And then they play in Vancouver at the old Pacific Coliseum. The next four games are in Moscow. And all four games in Moscow, bigger ice. Because the ice internationally is a bigger surface than it is in the games that we have here. And they thought, for example, the Kohl Center at Madison, they thought they're going to be going to bigger ice here. Actually, when the University of Wisconsin plays on a bigger ice surface. The ice here at Penn State will be 200 by 85, which is standard. So they play this series, and nobody knows about the Soviets except that they are the Olympic gold medalists year after year after year after year. They won in 64, won in 68, they won in 72. The United States beat them in 60 at Squaw Valley. So game one, so 2 weeks, right there, like, oh, yeah, we'll be fine, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and they jump out to a 2-0 lead. I mean, 30 seconds in, Phil Esposito scores. And after a 2-0 lead in the first 5 minutes, the Kennedy's like, hey, this is great. And the Soviets blitz the daylights out of them 7-3. They were shocked how good the Soviets were. Shocked. So then they go to Maple Leaf Gardens. Right? Ken Dryden gone, Tony Esposito in net. And they tie up the series, Team Canada does, at one apiece. They win 4-1. They go to Winnipeg, and this is the one tie in the series. And Canada had it. They were up 3-1 and 4-2 at one stage. And then the Soviets came back in 4-4. Then the fourth game was played in Vancouver. And Team Canada didn't play well. They lost 5-3, and the Canadians booed that team off the ice. boot him off the ice. So now they're down 2-1-1. And Phil Esposito made this speech on Canadian television while on the ice about how upset he was with the fans. Well, they go to game five. They finally go to Moscow. So now they're in Moscow. And the KGB is all over the place. I mean, this is a different time. So they play the Soviets at the Luzhniki Palace, the Ice Palace, and there's 3,000 Canadian fans there. I mean, the great, great fans. And the Canadians have trouble. Wayne Cashman got hurt in an exhibition game in Sweden. And Gilbert Perreault and Rick Martin both left to go to the Buffalo Sabres training camp. Huh? What? Well, Canada led the game 4-1 in game five and lost 5-4. Now, the Canadians are one loss away from losing the series, the unthinkable. So they play game six, and in game six, Bobby Clark deliberately slashes Valery Kharlamov in the ankle and breaks it. And Kharlamov had been a pain in their backside. Clark took care of that. But Paul Henderson scored the game winner in game six, 3-2. Game seven, Canada wins 4-3. Game winner, Paul Henderson, which was, by the way, an absolutely unbelievable goal. It was Orr-esque. And then game eight, with everything on the line, 36 seconds to go, who scores the game-winning goal? Paul Henderson. Thus, the three biggest goals in Canadian history, not the Sidney Crosby Olympic goal, but probably those three goals right there because of the sense of pride. Thus, my desire, by the way, over the next 3 months to somehow get Paul Henderson on the show.
I understand completely now. Took a little bit of an explanation, but I got you now.
In a hockey world, right, this is one of the more famous. I mean, there are very few moments. The Arruzioni goal may be the most famous goal in United States hockey history.
I would say that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, in Canadian hockey history, the Paul Henderson goal is it. I mean, that's it.
You know, it's always funny how we look back at 1980 and think of that game against the Soviets as being the big game, but that actually wasn't even the medal game.
No, it was not. It was not the medal game.
Was it the Finns?
Finland, and yeah. If the United States had lost that, I believe they would not have medaled. So, amazing. But they won it. And, yeah, they beat Finland 4-2. They were losing 2-1 going into the third period.
Right.
And came back and won.
I just always thought it was funny. People who had watched, we had talked about this a couple of weeks ago. We talked about favorite movies. I'd watched Miracle with some friends who had not experienced it before or remembered it the way I did because they're a little bit younger than I am. And didn't realize that that was not the gold medal game.
Right. That was not the gold medal game. No. More sports mythology. More sports mythology. That people would think it was. And I can understand why, because it's the famous game, but it's a game against Finland that finally won them the gold medal on a Sunday morning, no less. On a Sunday morning. But, yeah. Yeah, Paul Henderson. That's why I want Paul Henderson on the show. Sometime between now and September. I'll take care of that myself.
Yeah, you got time, though.
You don't have to worry about that, you know. Yeah.
Who would have guessed, though? And if and NHL fans, I'd love to hear from you. I mean, I've watched the NHL. I am not a follower. I'll be the first to admit it. I watch it, but I don't follow it. But I do know that L.A., with a shot at winning the Stanley Cup, not only the Stanley Cup in the first place really surprises me, but winning it in four straight or having the potential to win it in four straight makes it amazing to me.
Here's the amazing part. You need to win four series to win the Stanley Cup. Los Angeles has led 3-0 in all four series.
Yeah, that I just found out today. I did not realize that.
Yeah.
And they've never won a cup.
No. The original six happened to be the Detroit Red Wings, the Chicago Blackhawks, Toronto Maple Leafs, Montreal Canadiens, New York Rangers, Boston Bruins. And they had six teams up and through the 65-66 season. In 66-67, the NHL decided, let's expand. And we're going to expand in the United States. So they put six franchises out there. Philadelphia Flyers, who have won two Stanley Cups. The Pittsburgh Penguins, who have won three Stanley Cups. The Minnesota North Stars, who did not win any in Bloomington, but then have won since with the Dallas Stars. The St. Louis Blues, who have been to many a cup final, but have never won. The Oakland Seals.
That sounds like a made-up name.
Then became the California Golden Seals.
That sounds made up, too.
And then after not getting it done, they moved to Cleveland and became the Cleveland Barons. And then when they couldn't get it done for 2 years in Cleveland, they were then absorbed by the Minnesota North Stars. And the sixth one, the Los Angeles Kings, who were only in their second cup final looking for their first ever Stanley Cup. Those happen to be the second six, and that's where the Kings fall in. You're stunned.
I'm stunned with all the names. I mean, I swear you made up two of those names.
It's not how it works in the show, my man. It does not work that way.
What was it, the Oakland Seals?
The Oakland Seals, who then were renamed the California Golden Seals. They played at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum Arena.
The Oakland Seals?
Yes.
I mean, that makes more sense than the Mighty Ducks, to be honest with you, but okay.
They used to have the baseball team was the San Francisco Seals for years before the Giants.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, Joe DiMaggio played for the San Francisco Seals in the minors.
This is a very educational program.
In the Pacific Coast League. So the Oakland Seals, who then became the California Golden Seals, just could never make it, then moved to Cleveland, became the Cleveland Barons. The Gund brothers owned them. And then, after 2 years, couldn't make it a go, and then they were absorbed by the Minnesota North Stars.
You're going to have to take a break. I need to recover from all this.
All right, let's take a break. Today's show, of course, from the beautiful Sunbury Motors Studio, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Humble's Wharf. And the phone line, powered by Lenape Solar. Go to lenapesolar.com. Back with more after this. The Tramps from Saturday Night Fever. Burn, baby, burn.
I'm slightly impressed there, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, I heard the story about you in college and all the reel-to-reels, and none of it had music on it. So I didn't realize you were a music person, too.
You'll find out a lot of things on this show. You'll find out a lot of things.
You realize I have that audio and I'm saving it again for one special occasion somewhere down the road.
What?
The audio of walking in and seeing all these reel-to-reels laying all over the place.
Oh, you're talking about what Rick said.
Right.
Oh, what Rick said, yeah. Yeah. That's okay. I just got an email today that they have the pictures back from the day. Should be some entertaining stuff for you in there. I had you followed.
Great. I have this great photo I think we're going to post on the website. It's Steve doing what he always does, leaning one arm on the podium, kind of relaxed. I call it the Mr. Chill pose.
Oh, what, you want me to get up there and panic?
No, but it is all you, Mr. Chill, right there.
Tom Hart, Braves Television Network, and also Big Ten Network, next after the news.
This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, let's get to it here. We have Tom Hart, Braves Television Network, and also Big Ten Network. Braves and Marlins. Tom, are you hanging at the ballpark right now?
No, I'm sitting on my balcony in Key Biscayne. We've got two more in Miami. It's a tough life. I'm kind of disappointed. The palm trees are blocking the view of the adult pool, so I have to look over that to the beach view. And I'll make it, I think. I think I'll survive.
If you wish, I can delay for 60 seconds and make something up here and allow you to move just a little bit.
No, there will be no moving. I am anchored.
You're anchored. Yeah. What's happened? What has happened with the Braves? Great start, then a struggle. Where are they now?
Right now, they're playing great baseball, and that's easy to say coming off of an 11-0 win last night with Tim Hudson through 13th complete game of his career. But it's still a very inconsistent team. And if we're to talk tomorrow, I might say the starting pitching hasn't been there, and the hitting hasn't been consistent enough for this team to battle for the National League East title. And I think the surprise in the East certainly applies to the Braves, the fact that everyone outside of Philly, really, and we all know that they're going to be a second-half team, everyone's playing great baseball. The Mets have surprised the Nationals to be able to accomplish what they have with so many key injuries. It's been a fantastic year to be a fan of any team in the National League East because every night brings something new. So I think the Braves as a whole have had some inconsistencies with their starting pitching, which is the main concern. But perhaps if this team does have extended success, that's where it will come from. And a lot of inconsistencies with the batting order, mainly because so many key players have missed time, including Chipper Jones, who is eligible to come off the disabled list on Friday. More likely, probably, would be back in action after the weekend, perhaps Monday.
Also, Brian McCann's been day-to-day, too, and that's another key guy to have out.
Yeah, absolutely. He is such a key performer. And this is a lineup last year that really struggled with runners in scoring position. They struggled bringing guys home from third. It was either a home run or nothing, it seemed. And now there's still some inconsistencies, but there are so many good hitters peppered throughout this lineup. Freddie Freeman hit fifth last night. Jason Hayward's been hitting sixth or seventh. And when Chipper's in there, he's hitting anywhere from second to sixth, depending on the rest of the guys. And Dan Uggla, who had two home runs last night, can give you pop no matter where he is. And so they're a lineup that, when they get going, and it sometimes only takes one guy or two, everybody has success. And that's why you can see, double-digit performance like last night where they bang out 11 runs and a rookie shortstop has three hits. And Dan Uggla hits one off the sculpture in center field here at the ballpark in Miami. So it's a fun lineup to watch. But they're just as prone to have scoring 11 runs as they are to scoring one or two. So that kind of consistency is still something that everybody's looking for.
Tom, what about it was probably your first chance to go inside the Marlins Park, wasn't it, last
night?
Yeah,
what?
What do you think?
It's incredible. It's incredible. I'm not a Miami guy. I'm not a South Florida guy, and I don't know how many of your listeners have been down here. This place is different, and that's what I love about my travels. So many places in the United States these days are exactly the same. There's a strip mall over here. Here's where the mall is. Here's where the TGI Fridays is. And here's your Marriott courtyard. And you can picture it, can't you?
Well, you don't think I haven't lived the circuit?
Absolutely.
You and I run parallel universes.
That's why I love coming to a place like Miami or getting to San Francisco or New York City. And when you see this ballpark on TV, just like San Francisco, you know where the game is being played. No one else has a lime green wall. Nobody else has a 70-foot sculpture of jumping marlin and seagulls and a geyser of water that shoots out of it. And it's just a really neat ballpark. My only complaint, they're having some trouble getting the grass to grow. They haven't figured that out yet, which is common in retractable roof stadiums. But it is so gorgeous when the roof is open that when they decide to close it, you have this stark contrast of these, I don't know, they must be 50-foot high window panels that allow you to look out onto the Miami skyline. And then they close the roof, and it looks and feels like you're in a warehouse.
Right.
And so I think that's probably a common complaint to indoor stadiums, no matter where you are. But it's so beautiful when the roof is open. It'd be great if the climate would allow them to play with the roof open more often.
Right, and it's on the site of the old Orange Bowl, by the way. So Penn State
right
fans
there.
Have been there. Yeah,
it's right there on the side of the old Orange Bowl, and there were obviously so many great games played on the footprint where the Orange Bowl was built in the late 30s, I think 38. And, in fact, one of the iconic, and I'm a huge college football fan, obviously, but one of the iconic photos in all of sports is Joe Namath going off the field wagging a number one finger after winning Super Bowl III?
Yes.
Three?
Yes.
And that spot is now where he was exiting to go to the locker room is exactly where the Marlins dugout is now, about halfway up the third baseline. And so to imagine that and appreciate that, whether you're a football fan, NFL or college or not, I think it's really neat. And it's the neighborhood's still the same from people I talk to who have come to the Orange Bowl for years. You can go, you can park in a gleaming new parking garage, or you can go park in somebody's front yard. And it's fantastic.
Tell us what makes Michael Bourne a special player.
Oh, he's incredible. He's a guy that gets it in terms of a leadoff hitter. And he claims that, well, it's just, you know, you either know how you do it or you don't. And I asked him one time, I said, well, tell me what makes a good leadoff hitter. And he kind of deferred and said, I don't know. You can't just go up there and take pitches because you've got to be able to hit yourself. You've got to think about yourself, but at the same time, the rest of your team. And I asked him, I said, well, give me an example of that. And he said, if our pitcher just had a really long inning and I come to the plate and there's two outs, I know that he's sitting in that dugout thinking to himself, man, I wish I could get a couple more minutes of rest. And he said, at that point, you have to be a teammate and think to yourself, all right, I might see a fastball down the middle on the first pitch, but I'm going to work as long as I can and make this an 8 to 10 pitch at bat. And if I ground out, I ground out. But that gives my pitcher a little bit more rest before we go back out there. Now, his tools are amazing. He has speed that's off the charts. He has shown more power in the last 2 weeks than he has throughout his entire career. No one has more stolen bases than him over the last 3 years in all of baseball. And he's a guy that sets the tone for the rest of a lineup that I told you earlier has been inconsistent. So when he gets on base, and he does it more often than not, I think, I don't know what the numbers are now, 18 of the last 25 games or something like that, he's led off by getting on base. That just gives your entire lineup a boost. It's just, he's a free agent after this year, and so Braves fans are all anxiously awaiting what happens with his contract. They want him to do well because he's such a key component of this team, yet they also know that with every great game, Scott Boras licks his chops a little bit more.
And he has a long list of clients like that. By the way, he sure does, including Mark Appella, who was the Pirates' first-round pick. He's a Boras guy. That's what makes that one pick interesting at number 8. I want to get to Chipper Jones for a moment. I know he's been out, and I think he's missed, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 games this year. But it's his last go-around, and it is a rarity in baseball, because of the nature of free agency, to play their entire career in one spot. He's going to do that. What are your thoughts on what he is like to deal with on a daily basis? And at this stage of his career, does he still have it?
He absolutely has it. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the Braves' record with him in the lineup versus with without him in the lineup are staggering. And that, to me, speaks to his leadership. He's not a big rah-rah guy, but he makes everyone in the lineup better. And maybe that's because they see different pitches, because they worry about Chipper, or maybe it's because the pitcher's focus is on Chipper instead of on the guy currently at the plate. But whatever it is, he has that hit. Now, he grew up a huge Mickey Mantle fan, and he also grew up a Dodgers fan because he's from near Vero Beach, so his dad was a big Dodgers fan. And he's been so great this season because he has an appreciation for his career and the game of baseball, and so he's taking everything in. He had a game-winning hit in the ninth inning at Dodger Stadium back in late April, and he said, this is what I always dreamed of as a kid, you know, to win a game at Dodger Stadium. And it's rare these days to have any professional athlete, especially one who's been around so long, kind of show their vulnerability and say that this is a dream of mine. He had a walk-off home run against the Phillies in a game the Braves were down 6-0 to Doc Holliday. They came back once. They gave the lead up. They came back again. They gave the lead up. They came back a third time, and they finally won it when Chipper hit a walk-off. And I asked him after the game, I said, what is that feeling? And he said, I wish everyone could experience this. He said, it's indescribable, but to be able to win a game like this at home in front of your fans against a team like the Phillies. Steve, I don't know if that's an answer that he gives 3 years ago or 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, but he said that night, he said, of all the games I've been a part of, this one takes the cake. I thought, wow, here's a guy who's won a batting title. He's won a World Series. He was a part of an organization that went from worst to first, and he's been around and been played with numerous Hall of Famers and has won himself. And to say that about a Wednesday night game against the Phillies in May really shows me that he's trying to take everything in this year and appreciate every at-bat, every inning, every ball game, every teammate, and every experience.
Well, let's get to the rarefied airport so that people understand what they're watching. Probably in the history of the game, the three top switch hitters, average home runs, and recognition are probably Mickey Mantle, Eddie Murray, and Chipper Jones. Safe statement?
I don't think about it. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And those, Mickey Mantle's his idol. Eddie Murray's a guy that he greatly respects. Chipper has an enormous amount of respect for the history of the game, for the way to play the game, the right way. And that was evident earlier this season when the Braves were playing in Colorado and Jamie Moyer accused Chipper of stealing signs from second base. And I think accusations like that are common in the game of baseball, and sniping between especially a guy who was, with the Phillies for so long. Sniping between rivals is probably pretty common, trash talking, if you will. But Chipper was so upset that he would be called out in such a manner and that his integrity to the game of baseball was called out when nobody knew about it. You know, it happened on the field between the mound and Chipper at second base. No one had to know about it. But he made a point to say, listen, I offered to meet Jamie in the tunnel after the game to discuss what his concerns may be, but you just can't call out my integrity to the game of baseball like that and not expect a response.
Right.
And I think that speaks a lot to his competitiveness and to what the game of baseball is, the big picture, when I say the game of baseball, means to him.
What have you enjoyed about the Big Ten Network component of your life?
That's a great question. I think what I've enjoyed the most is I had a chance to do a lot of great college football before I got to the Big Ten. And I had a chance to do some games that weren't really that big a deal. In fact, I was covering Case Keenum and the great Houston team. And we would leave the hotel, which was 3 miles from the stadium, on Saturday morning. And as we're checking out at the front desk, the the nice lady would say, so what brings you guys in town? Well, we're here for the football game. And she and many of the guests in the hotel would have no idea that there was a football game going on within 3 miles of their hotel. The passion of the fans in every Big Ten community is just overwhelming to me. And it is so appreciated. And not that we have more eyeballs. I don't really care how many people are watching our telecast or the game. I just like to be part of something that's so important to people. And whether that's at Penn State or Indiana, I see that passion every weekend. And every time we go into a stadium, and every time we walk through a campus and you see, you know, the kids. And then on Saturday morning, the students, the kids tossing the football, the dad, the granddad, generations that support their program and State U, if you want to put it like that, no matter where you are, I think is second to none. And this is coming from a guy who lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and is surrounded by the SEC. They obviously have great tradition. But I put those two leagues on par with each other when it comes to the passion of their fans and the fact that it's ingrained in families from generation to generation.
People ask me about preparing for a game, and I say, well, in my part, it's relatively easy. I really have one team to worry about, and that's getting ready for whomever Penn State's playing. I'm around them every day, thus I have the preparation in front of me. For you, you have to prepare for two teams every week, or in the case of basketball, sometimes four, because you'll have a couple of games in a week. Give us an idea that the time and what you put into your preparation, because you need so much to be even-handed on both sides.
I think that's a great point. And even more than being even-handed, it's the need to prepare for multiple storylines when maybe only one is going to come to the surface. So for a college football game, it's typically when I'm on the flight home on Saturday, I'm already working on my charts for the next week. For a game that's 7 days away, and there's 40 hours of work that goes into watching film, reading articles, conference calls, talking to coaches, talking to players, and most of that, even that occurs before we get to campus, on Thursday or Friday. Nothing can take the place of being there. So when my schedule allows, I try to get in to go to practice on Thursday. Had a chance to do that at Penn State this year. Mm-hmm. Did it at Ohio State. Did it at Michigan. And you see, you're able to pick up on little things in a Thursday practice. I mean, the tiniest of things. A goal line situation where they run the same play action to the tight end five times because they want to make sure they get it right. Well, that's probably going to be a big play come Saturday. Or a fake punt that they run five times just to make sure everyone's timing is down and we might use it. And to be able to see that and recognize it via formation or via game situation before it occurs gives broadcast team an enormous advantage. All of that prep work, then you put it all in and you can't. You can't plan on it. You can't plan on what the game is going to be. So I think to really do the viewers right, the toughest thing to do for both teams is to recognize an emerging storyline, whether that appears in the first quarter, second quarter, or fourth quarter. And I'll give you a quick example. When Ohio State went into Purdue last year, we had the game, and one of the storylines was, can Purdue beat Ohio State at home for the second time in 3 years? And Ohio State fans kind of grew weary of that storyline because they didn't want to hear it. They wanted their team to win. It became readily apparent that in the fourth quarter when Ohio State needed a touchdown drive, that they could not throw the ball. And the only way they can convert a third and long was for Braxton Miller to run it. So, okay, well, that's obvious. This is a storyline. If they're going to win this game, it's going to be on a freshman quarterback that can't throw the ball, but he can run. On the other hand, they ended up scoring the game-tying touchdown, but then had the extra point blocked, and Purdue won it in overtime thanks to Robert Marv. And within the last 7 minutes of game action, the storyline became Robert Marv, a quarterback who had become a journeyman in the world of college football, who had battled injuries left and right, from car crashes to a torn ACL to hand and wrist injuries, and as a five-star recruit was promised the world, and it never came to him. And now all of a sudden, as one of four quarterbacks that Purdue had used last season, he had a chance for a signature win, and he made two big plays down the stretch. And the story over the first 7 minutes was completely different than what it was 3.5 hours before. It was Robert Marv getting his signature victory. And if you don't know his background, you haven't done the research, or you're not able to recognize those storylines as they emerge, they just kind of fall to the cutting room floor, and it's a missed opportunity. And I think it's unfair to the fans that recognize that. So that's the toughest part when you're trying to play a broadcast down the middle, to me.
And that is why I've said many times on the show, he's one of the best you'll see. Tom, thanks so much for the time you gave us. Can't wait to catch up with you again, maybe a little later in the season. And obviously, when you get here to Penn State, I can't wait to see you.
Thanks for the kind words. Ditto. Thank you so much.
Tom Harton with us, Braves Network. Good, close, personal friend of Kevin Herr. But then aren't they all? Back with more after this.
When you buy anything, isn't it best to see people who've been around for a long time, satisfying customers just like you all the time? Makes sense, doesn't it? So when you're in the market for a quality new or pre-owned vehicle, the only place to go is Sunbury Motors. They've been in business since 1915, partnering up folks just like you with a vehicle that best suits their needs and budget. Their service after the sale can't be beat. And if you like selection, there's none better than Sunbury Motors. Fords, Kias, Lincolns, Mercurys, Hyundais, Sunbury Motors sells them all. Their finance teams are unmatched. They'll be glad to help you secure the affordable option you want on any new or pre-owned vehicle you find on their lots. See the people who've been in business since 1915. Sunbury Motors Ford, Lincoln Mercury, and Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com.
Top of the hour, that means CBS News and Sarah Bartlett. Then in the next hour, Ron Cook, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Bill Carollo, Big Ten football official supervisor tomorrow, along with Rick Boyages on men's basketball, Dick Girardi, Belmont Stakes on Friday.